Do you believe that?
No.
Perhaps he should have lied and told her what she wanted to hear, but Davis was too accustomed to speaking truth.
You are the Mother of Darkness. I saw that under Storm's End when you gave birth before my eyes.
Is the brave Sir Onions so frightened of a passing shadow?
Take heart, then. Shadows only live when given birth by light,
and the king's fires burn so low, I dare not draw off any more to make another son. It might well kill him.
Melisande moved closer.
With another man, though, a man whose flames still burn hot and high. If you truly wish to serve your king's cause, come to my chamber one night. I could give you pleasure such as you have never known. And with your life fire, I could make
a horror. Davis retreated from her. I want no part of you, my lady, or your god. May the Seven protect me.
Melisande sighed. They did not protect Gunther Sunglass. He prayed thrice each day, and bore seven-pointed stars upon his shield. But when R'hllor reached out his hand, his prayers turned to screams, and he burned. Why cling to these false gods?
I have worshipped them all my life.
All your life, Davis Seaworth, as we'll say, it was so yesterday. She shook her head sadly. You have never feared to speak the truth to kings. Why do you lie to yourself? Open your eyes, Sir Knight.
What is it you would have me see?
The way the world is made. The truth is all around you, plain to behold. The night is dark and full of terrors. The day bright and beautiful and full of hope. One is black, the other white. There is ice, and there is fire, hate and love, bitter and sweet, male and female, pain and pleasure, winter and summer, evil and good. She took a step toward him. Death and life. Everywhere opposites. Everywhere the war.
The war? Asked Davis.
The war, she affirmed. There are two, Onion Knight. Not seven, not one, not 100 or 1,000, two. Do you think I cross half the world to put yet another vain king on yet another empty throne? The war has been waged since time began, and before it is done, all men must choose where they will stand. On one side is R'hllor, the Lord of Light, the Heart of Fire, the god of flame and shadow. Against him stands the Great Other, whose name may not be spoken, the Lord of Darkness, the Soul of Ice, the god of night and terror. Ours is not a choice between Baratheon and Lannister, between Greyjoy and Stark. It is death we choose, or life, darkness or light.
She clasped the bars of his cell with her slender white hands. The great ruby at her throat seemed to pulse with its own radiance.
So tell me, Sir Davis Seaworth, and tell me truly, does your heart burn with the shining light of R'hllor, or is it black and cold and full of worms?
She reached through the bars and laid three fingers upon his breast, as if to feel the truth of him, through flesh and wool and leather.
My heart, Davis said slowly, is full of doubts.
Melisande sighed.
Ah, Davis, the good knight is honest to the last, even in his day of darkness. It is well you did not lie to me. I would have known. The other servants often hide black hearts in gaudy light. Sir R'hllor gives his priests the power to see through their falsehoods.
She stepped lightly away from the cell.
Why did you mean to kill me?
I will tell you, said Davis, if you will tell me who betrayed me. It could only have been Salador San, and yet even now he prayed it was not so. The Red Woman laughed.
No one betrayed you, Onion Knight. I saw your purpose in my flames.
The flames? If you can see the future in these flames, how is it that we burned upon the Blackwater? You gave my sons to the fire, my sons, my ship, my men, all burning.
Melisande shook her head. You wrong me, Onion Knight. Those were no fires of mine. Had I been with you, your battle would have had a different ending. But his grace was surrounded by unbelievers, and his pride proved stronger than his faith. His punishment was grievous, but he has learned from his mistake.
Were my sons no more than a lesson for a king, then?
Davis felt his mouth tighten. It is night in your seven kingdoms now, the Red Woman went on, but soon the sun will rise again. The war continues, Davis Seaworth, and some will soon learn that even an ember in the ashes can still ignite a great blaze. The old maester looked at Stannis and saw only a man. You see a king. You are both wrong. He is the Lord's chosen, the warrior of fire. I have seen him leading the fight against the dark. I have seen it in the flames. The flames do not lie. Else you would not be here. It is written in prophecy as well. When the red star bleeds and the darkness gathers, Azor Ahai shall be born again amidst smoke and salt to wake dragons out of stone. The bleeding star has come and gone, and Dragonstone is the place of smoke and salt. Stannis Baratheon is Azor Ahai reborn.
Her red eyes blazed like twin fires and seemed to stare deep into his soul.
You do not believe me. You doubt the truth of R'hllor even now. Yet have served him all the same and will serve him again. I shall leave you here to think on all that I have told you, and because R'hllor is the source of all good, I shall leave the torch as well.
With a smile and a swirl of scarlet skirts, she was gone. Only her scent lingered after, that and the torch. Davos lowered himself to the floor of the cell and wrapped his arms about his knees. The shifting torchlight washed over him. Once Melisande's footsteps faded away, the only sound was the scrabbling of rats.
Ice and fire, he thought, black and white, dark and light.
Davis could not deny the power of her guard. He had seen the shadow crawling from Melisande's womb, and the priestess knew things she had no way of knowing.
She saw my purpose in her flames.
It was good that Sala had not sold him, but the thought of the Red Woman spying out his secrets with her fires disquieted him more than he could say.
And what did she mean when she said that I had served her God and would serve him again?
He did not like that either. He lifted his eyes to stare up at the torch. He looked for a long time, never blinking, watching the flames shift and shimmer. He tried to see beyond them, to peer beyond the fiery curtain and glimpse whatever lived back there. But there was nothing, only fire, and after a time his eyes began to water. God blind and tired, Davis curled up on the straw and gave himself to sleep. 3 days later, well, porridge had come thrice and lamprey twice, Davis heard voices outside his cell. He sat up at once, his back to the stone wall, listening to the sounds of struggle. This was new, a change in his unchanging world. The noise was coming from the left, where the steps led up to daylight. He could hear a man's voice pleading and shouting,
"Madness!
the man was saying as he came into view, dragged along between two guardsmen with fiery hearts on their breasts. Porridge went before them, jangling a ring of keys, and Sir Axel Florent walked behind. "Axel," the prisoner asked desperately, "for the love you bear me, unhand me! You cannot do this! I'm no traitor!" He was an older man, tall and slender, with silvery grey hair, a pointed beard, and a long, elegant face twisted in fear. "Where is Selyse? Where is the Queen? I demand to see her! The others take you all! Release me!" The guards paid no mind to his outcries. "Here?" Porridge asked in front of the cell. Davis got to his feet. For an instant he considered trying to rush them when the door was open, but that was madness. There were too many. The guards wore swords, and Porridge was strong as a bull. Sir Axel gave the jailer a curt nod. "Let the traitors enjoy each other's company."
"I am no traitor!"
screeched the prisoner as Porridge was unlocking the door. Though he was plainly dressed in grey wool doublet and black breeches, his speech marked him as high-born.
"His birth will not serve him here," thought Davis.
Porridge swung the bars wide. Sir Axel gave a nod, and the guards flung their charge in headlong. The man stumbled and might have fallen, but Davis caught him. At once he wrenched away and staggered back toward the door, only to have it slammed in his pale, pampered face.
"No!" he shouted. "No!"
All the strength suddenly left his legs, and he slid slowly to the floor, clutching at the iron bars. Sir Axel, Porridge, and the guards had already turned to leave.
"You cannot do this!"
the prisoner shouted at their retreating backs.
"I am the King's hand!"
It was then that Davis knew him.
"You are Alastair Florent."
The man turned his head.
"Who?"
"Sir Davis Seaworth."
Lord Alastair blinked.
"Seaworth? The Onion Knight? You tried to murder Melisande."
Davis did not deny it.
"At Storm's End, you wore red gold armor with inlaid lapis flowers on your breastplate."
He reached down a hand to help the other man to his feet. Lord Alastair brushed the filthy straw from his clothing.
I must apologize for my appearance, sir. My chests were lost when the Lannisters overran our camp. I escaped with no more than the mail on my back and the rings on my fingers."
"He still wears those rings," noted Davis, who had lacked even all of his fingers.
"No doubt some cook's boy or groom is prancing around King's Landing just now in my slashed velvet doublet and jewelled cloak,"
Lord Alastair went on, oblivious.
"But war has its horrors, as all men know. No doubt you have suffered your own losses."
"My ship," said Davis, "all my men, four of my sons."
"Oh, may the Lord of Light lead them through the darkness to a better world," the other man said.
"May the Father judge them justly, and the Mother grant them mercy," Davis thought,
but he kept his prayer to himself. The Seven had no place on Dragonstone now.
"My own son is safe at Brightwater," the Lord went on, "but I lost a nephew on the Fury, Sir Emry, my brother Ryan's son."
It had been Sir Emry Florent who led them blindly up the Blackwater Rush, with all oars pulling, paying no heed to the small stone towers at the mouth of the river. Davis was not like to forget him.
"My son Marek was your nephew's oarmaster."
He remembered his last sight of Fury engulfed in wildfire.
"Has there been any word of survivors?"
"The Fury burned and sank with all hands," his lordship said. "Your son and my nephew were lost with countless other good men. The war itself was lost that day, sir."
"This man is defeated."
Davis remembered Melisande's talk of embers in the ashes igniting great blazes.
"Small wonder he ended here." "His grace will never yield, my lord." "Folly, that's folly."
Lord Alastair sat on the floor again, as if the effort of standing for a moment had been too much for him.
"Stannis Baratheon will never sit the Iron Throne. Is it treason to say the truth?"
A bitter truth, but no less true for that. His fleet is gone, save for the Lyseni, and Salazar's arm will flee at the first sight of a Lannister sail. Most of the lords who supported Stannis have gone over to Joffrey, or died. Even the lords of the Narrow Sea? The lord sworn to Dragonstone?
Lord Alistair waved his hand feebly. Lord Celtigar was captured and bent the knee. Montfort Velaryon died with his ship. The Red Woman burned Sunglass, and Lord Bar-Eamon is 15 fat and feeble. Those are your lords of the Narrow Sea. Only the strength of House Florin is left to Stannis, against all the might of Highgarden, Sunspear, and Castle Rock, and now most of the Stormlords as well. The best hope that remains is to try and salvage something with a peace. That is all I meant to do. Gods be good, how can they call it treason?
Davos stood frowning. My lord, what did you do?
Not treason. Never treason. I love his grace as much as any man. My own niece is his queen, and I remain loyal to him when wiser men fled. I am his hand, the hand of the king. How can I be a traitor? I only meant to save our lives and honor. Yes. He licked his lips. I penned a letter. Salador Zahn swore that he had a man who could get it to King's Landing to Lord Tywin. His lordship is a man of reason, and my terms, the terms were fair, more than fair.
What terms were these, my lord?
It is filthy here, Lord Alistair said suddenly, and that odour, what is that odour?
A pale, said Davos, gesturing. We have no privy here. What terms?
His lordship stared at the pale in horror.
That Lord Stannis give up his claim to the Iron Throne and retract all he said of Joffrey's bastardy, on the condition that he be accepted back into the King's Peace and confirmed as Lord of Dragonstone and Storm's End. I vow to do the same, for the return of Brightwater Keep and all our lands. I thought Lord Tywin would see the sense in my proposal. He still has the Starks to deal with, and the Iron Men as well. I offer to seal the bargain by wedding Shireen to Joffrey's brother Tommen.
He shook his head.
The terms, they were as good as we are ever like to get. Even you can see that, surely. Yes, said Davos. Even me.
Unless Tannis should father a son, such a marriage would mean that Dragonstone and Storm's End would one day pass to Tommen, which would doubtless please Lord Tywin. Meanwhile, the Lannisters would have Shireen as hostage to make certain Stannis raise no new rebellions.
And what did his grace say when you proposed these terms to him?
He's always with the Red Woman, and is not in his right mind, I fear. This talk of a stone dragon, madness. I tell you, sheer madness. Did we learn nothing from Arian Brightfire? From the Nine Majors, from the Alchemists, did we learn nothing from Summer Hall? No good has ever come from these dreams of dragons. I told Axel as much. My way was better, surer, and Stannis gave me his seal. He gave me leave to rule. The hand speaks with the king's voice.
Not in this.
Davos was no courtier, and he did not even try to blunt his words.
It is not in Stannis to yield, so long as he knows his claim is just. No more than he can unsay his words against Joffrey when he believes them true. As for the marriage, Tommen was born of the same incest as Joffrey, and his grace would sooner see Shireen dead than wed to such.
A vein throbbed in Florin's forehead.
He has no choice. Oh, you are wrong, my lord. He can choose to die a king. And us with him? Is that what you desire, Onion Knight? No, but I am the king's man, and I will make no peace
without his leave.
Lord Alastair stared at him helplessly for a long moment, and then began to weep. John. The last night fell black and moonless, but for once the sky was clear. "I'm going up the hill to look for Ghost," he told the Fens at the cave mouth, and they grunted and let him pass.
"So many stars," he thought, as he trudged up the slope through pines and firs and ash. Maester Lewin had taught him his stars as a boy at Winterfell. He had learned the names of the 12 houses of heaven and the rulers of each. He could find the 7 wanderers sacred to the faith. He was old friends with the Ice Dragon, the Shadow Cat, the Moon Maid, and the Sword of the Morning. All those he shared with Ygritte, but not some of the others. "We look up at the same stars and see different things. The King's Crown was the cradle, to hear her tell it. The Stallion was the Horned Lord. The Red Wanderer, that Septons preached was sacred to their smith up here, was called the Thief. And when the Thief was in the Moon Maid, that was a propitious time for a man to steal a woman," Ygritte insisted. "Like the night you stole me. The Thief was bright that night." "I never meant to steal you," he said. "I never knew you were a girl until my knife was at your throat."
"If you kill a man and never meant it, he's just as dead," Ygritte said stubbornly. John had never met anyone so stubborn, except maybe for his little sister Arya. "Is she still my sister?" he wondered. "Was she ever?"
He had never truly been a Stark, only Lord Eddard's motherless bastard, with no more a place at Winterfell than Theon Greyjoy. And even that he'd lost. When a man of the Night's Watch said his words, he put aside his old family and joined a new one. But Jon Snow had lost those brothers too. He found Ghost atop the hill, as he thought he might. The White Wolf never howled, yet something drew him to the heights all the same, and he would squat there on his hindquarters, hot breath rising in a white mist as his red eyes drank the stars. "Do you have names for them as well?" John asked, as he went to one knee beside the dire wolf and scratched the thick white fur on his neck. "The Hare, the Doe, the She-Wolf." Ghost licked his face, his rough, wet tongue rasping against the scabs where the eagle's talons had ripped John's cheek. "The bird marked both of us," he thought. "Ghost," he said quietly, "on the morrow we go over. There's no steps here, no cage and crane, no way for me to get you to the other side. We have to part. Do you understand?" In the dark, the dire wolf's red eyes looked black. He nuzzled at John's neck, silent as ever, his breath a hot mist. The wildlings called Jon Snow a warg, but if so, he was a poor one. He did not know how to put on a wolfskin, the way Orel had with his eagle before he died. Once John had dreamed that he was Ghost, looking down upon the valley of the Milkwater where Mance Rayder had gathered his people, and that dream had turned out to be true. But he was not dreaming now, and that left him only words. "You cannot come with me," John said, cupping the wolf's head in his hands and looking deep into those eyes. "You have to go to Castle Black, do you understand? Castle Black? Can you find it? The way home? Just follow the ice, east and east, into the sun, and you'll find it. They will know you at Castle Black, and maybe your coming will warn them." He had thought of writing out a warning for Ghost to carry, but he had no ink, no parchment, not even a writing quill, and the risk of discovery was too great. "I will meet you again at Castle Black, but you have to get there by yourself. We must each hunt alone for a time." Alone. The direwolf twisted free of John's grasp, his ears pricked up, and suddenly he was bounding away. He loped through a tangle of brush, leapt to deadfall, and raced down the hillside, a pale streak among the trees. "Off to Castle Black?" John wondered. "Or off after a hare?" He wished he knew. He feared he might prove just as poor a warg as a sworn brother and a spy. A wind sighed through the trees, rich with the smell of pine needles, tugging at his faded blacks. John could see the wall looming high and dark to the south, a great shadow blocking out the stars. The rough hilly ground made him think they must be somewhere between the Shadow Tower and Castle Black, and likely closer to the former. For days they had been wending their way south, between deep lakes that stretched like long, thin fingers along the floors of narrow valleys, while flint ridges and pine-clad hills jostled against one another to either side. Such ground made for slow riding, but offered easy concealment for those wishing to approach the wall unseen. "For wilding raiders," he thought, "like us, like me." Beyond the wall lay the Seven Kingdoms, and everything he had sworn to protect. He had said the words, had pledged his life and honour, and by rights he should be up there standing sentry. He should be raising a horn to his lips to rouse the night's watch to arms. He had no horn, though. It would not be hard to steal one from the wildlings, he suspected, but what would that accomplish? Even if he blew it, there was no one to hear. The wall was 100 leagues long, and the watch sadly dwindled. All but 3 of the strongholds had been abandoned. There might not be a brother within 40 miles of here but for John, if he was a brother still. I should have tried to kill Mansraider on the fist, even if it meant my life. That was what Corin Halfhand would have done. But John had hesitated, and the chance had passed. The next day he had ridden off with Stir the Magnar, Jarl, and more than 100 picked Thens and raiders. He told himself that he was only biding his time, that when the moment came he would slip away and ride for Castle Black. The moment never came. They rested most nights in empty wildling villages, and Stir always set a dozen of his Thens to guard the horses. Jarl watched him suspiciously, and Ygritte was never far, day or night. Two hearts that beat as one. Mansraider's mocking words rang bitter in his head. John had seldom felt so confused. "I have no choice," he told himself the first time, when she slipped beneath his sleeping skins. "If I refuse her, she will know me for a turncloak. I'm playing the part the Halfhand told me to play." His body had played the part eagerly enough. His lips on hers, his hand sliding under her doeskin shirt to find a breast, his manhood stiffening when she rubbed her mound against it through their clothes. "My vows," he'd thought, remembering the weirwood grove where he had said them, the 9 great white trees in a circle, the carved red faces watching, listening. But her fingers were undoing his laces, and her tongue was in his mouth, and her hand slipped inside his small clothes and brought him out. And he could not see the weirwoods any more, only her. She bit his neck, and he nuzzled hers, burying his nose in her thick red hair. "Lucky," he thought. "She is lucky. Fire-kissed." "Isn't that good?" she whispered, as she guided him inside her. She was sopping wet down there, and no maiden, that was plain, but John did not care. His vows, her maidenhood, none of it mattered, only the heat of her, the mouth on his, the finger that pinched at his nipple. "Isn't that sweet?" she said again. "Not so fast. Oh, slow. Yes, like that. There now, yes. Sweet, sweet. You know nothing, Jon Snow, but I can show you. Harder now. Yes." "A part," he tried to remind himself afterwards. "I am playing a part. I had to do it once to prove I'd abandoned my vows. I had to make her trust me." It need never happen again. He was still a man of the Night's Watch and a son of Eddard Stark. He'd done what needed to be done, proved what needed to be proven. The proving had been so sweet, though, and Ygritte had gone to sleep beside him with her head against his chest,
and that was sweet as well, dangerously sweet. He thought of the weirwoods again, and the words he'd said before them.
It was only once, and it had to be. Even my father stumbled once, when he forgot his marriage vows and sired a bastard.
John vowed to himself that it would be the same with him.
It will never happen again.
It happened twice more that night, and again in the morning, when she woke to find him hard. The wildlings were stirring by then, and several could not help but notice what was going on beneath the pile of furs. Jarl told them to be quick about it before he had to throw a pail of water over them.
Like a pair of rutting dogs, John thought afterwards. Was that what he'd become?
I am a man of the night's watch, a small voice inside insisted. But every night it seemed a little fainter, and when Ygritte kissed his ears or bit his neck, he could not hear it at all.
Was this how it was for my father? He wondered. Was he as weak as I am, when he dishonored himself in my mother's bed?
Something was coming up the hill behind him, he realized suddenly. For half a heartbeat he thought it might be Ghost come back, but the direwolf never made so much noise. John drew Longclaw in a single, smooth motion. But it was only one of the Thens, a broad man in a bronze helm.
"Snow," the intruder said. "Come, Magna wants."
The men of Thenn spoke the old tongue, and most had only a few words of the common. John did not much care what the Magna wanted, but there was no use arguing with someone who could scarce understand him, so he followed the man back down the hill. The mouth of the cave was a cleft in the rock, barely wide enough for a horse, half concealed behind a soldier pine. It opened to the north so the glows of the fires within would not be visible from the wall. Even if by some mischance a patrol should happen to pass atop the wall tonight, they would see nothing but hills and pines and the icy sheen of starlight on a half-frozen lake. Mance Rayder had planned his thrust well. Within the rock the passage descended 20 feet before it opened out onto a space as large as Winterfell's great hall. Cook fires burned amongst the columns, their smoke rising to blacken the stony ceiling. The horses had been hobbled along one wall beside a shallow pool. A sinkhole in the centre of the floor opened on what might have been an even greater cavern below, though the darkness made it hard to tell. John could hear the soft rushing sound of an underground stream somewhere below as well. Jarl was with the Magna. Mance had given them the joint command. Stir was none too pleased by that, John had noted early on. Mance Rayder had called the dark youth a pet of Val, who was sister to Darla, his own queen, which made Jarl a sort of good brother once removed to the king beyond the wall. The Magna plainly resented sharing his authority. He had brought 100 Thens, 5 times as many as Jarl, and often acted as if he had the sole command. But it would be the younger man who got them over the ice, John knew. Though he could not have been older than 20, Jarl had been raiding for 8 years, and had gone over the wall 12 times with the likes of Alfin Crowkiller and the Weeper, and more recently with his own band. The Magna was direct.
"Jarl has warned me of crows patrolling on high. Tell me all you know of these patrols."
"Tell me," John noted, "not tell us," though Jarl stood right beside him. He would have liked nothing better than to refuse the brusque demand, but he knew Stir would put him to death at the slightest disloyalty, and Ygritte as well, for the crime of being his. "There are 4 men in each patrol, 2 rangers and 2 builders, he said. "The builders are supposed to make note of cracks, melting, and other structural problems, while the rangers look for signs of foes. They ride mules."
"Mules," the earless man frowned. "Mules are slow."
"Slow, but more sure-footed on the ice. The patrols often ride atop the wall, and aside from Castle Black, the paths up there have not been gravelled for long years. The mules are bred at Eastwatch, and specially trained to their duty."
"They often ride atop the wall, not always."
"No, 1 patrol in 4 follows the base instead, to search for cracks in the foundation ice, or signs of tunneling. The Magnar nodded.
Even in Far Then, we know the tale of arson, ice axe, and his tunnel.
John knew the tale as well. Arson Isaacs had been halfway through the wall when his tunnel was found by rangers from the night fort. They did not trouble to disturb him at his digging, only sealed the way behind, with ice and stone and snow. Dollar's Ed used to say that if you pressed your ear flat to the wall, you could still hear arson chipping away with his axe.
"When do these patrols go out? How often?"
John shrugged. "It changes. I've heard that Lord Commander Corgill used to send them out every third day from Castle Black to Eastwatch by the sea, and every second day from Castle Black to the Shadow Tower. The watch had more men in his day, though. Lord Commander Mormont prefers to vary the number of patrols and the days of their departure to make it more difficult for anyone to know their comings and goings. And sometimes the old bear will even send a larger force to one of the abandoned castles for a fortnight or a moon's turn. His uncle had originated that tactic, John knew. Anything to make the enemy on shore.
"Is Stone Door manned at present?" asked Jarl. "Grey Guard?"
"So we're between these two, are we?" John kept his face carefully blank. "Only Eastwatch, Castle Black, and the Shadow Tower were manned when I left the wall. I can't speak to what Bowen Marsh or Sir Dennis might have done since."
"How many crows remain within the castle?" asked Stir.
500 at Castle Black, 200 at Shadow Tower, perhaps 300 at Eastwatch." John added 300 men to the count. If only it were that easy. Jarl was not fooled, however.
"He's lying," he told Stir, "or else including those they lost on a fist."
"Crow," the Magnar warned, "do not take me for Mance Raider. If you lie to me, I will have your tongue."
"I'm no crow, and I won't be called a liar." John flexed the fingers of his sword hand. The Magnar of Then studied John with his chilly grey eyes.
"We shall learn their numbers soon enough," he said after a moment. "Go. I will send for you if I have further questions."
John bowed his head stiffly and went. If all the wildlings were like Stir, it would be easier to betray them. The Thens were not like other free folk, though. The Magna claimed to be the last of the First Men and ruled with an iron hand. His little land of Then was a high mountain valley hidden amongst the northernmost peaks of the Frostfangs, surrounded by cave dwellers, Hornfoot men, giants, and the cannibal clans of the Ice Rivers. Ygritte said the Thens were savage fighters, and that their Magnar was a god to them. John could believe that. Unlike Jarl and Harmer and Rattleshirt, Stir commanded absolute obedience from his men, and that discipline was no doubt part of why Mance had chosen him to go over the wall. He walked past the Thens, sitting atop their rounded bronze helms about their cookfires. Where did Ygritte get herself to? He found her gear and his together, but no sign of the girl herself.
"She took her torch and went off that way,"
Grig the goat told him, pointing toward the back of the cavern. John followed his finger and found himself in a dim back room, wandering through a maze of columns and stalactites.
"She can't be here,"
he was thinking, when he heard her laugh. He turned toward the sound, but within 10 paces he was in a dead end, facing a blank wall of rose and white flowstone. Baffled, he made his way back the way he'd come, and then he saw it, a dark hole under an outthrust of wet stone. He knelt, listened, heard the faint sound of water.
"Ygritte! In here!"
Her voice came back, echoing faintly. John had to crawl a dozen paces before the cave opened up around him. When he stood again, it took his eyes a moment to adjust. Ygritte had brought a torch, but there was no other light. She stood beside a little waterfall that fell from a cleft in the rock down into a wide, dark pool. The orange and yellow flames shone against the pale green water.
"What are you doing here?" he asked her.
I heard water. I wanted to see how deep the cave went.
She pointed with the torch.
There's a passage goes down further. I followed it 100 paces before I turned back.
A dead end?
You know nothing, Jon Snow. It went on and on and on. There are hundreds of caves in these hills, and deep down they all connect. There's even a way under your wall. Gorn's way.
Gorn, said Jon. Gorn was king beyond the wall.
Aye, said Ygritte, together with his brother Gendel 3,000 years ago. They led a host of free folk through the caves, and the watch was none the wiser. But when they come out, the wolves of Winterfell fell upon them.
There was a battle, Jon recalled. Gorn slew the king in the north, but his son picked up his banner and took the crown from his head and cut down Gorn in turn.
And the sound of swords woke the crows in their castles, and they rode out all in black to take the free folk in the rear.
Yes, Gendel had the king to the south, the Umbers to the east, and the watch to the north of him. He died as well.
You know nothing, Jon Snow. Gendel did not die. He cut his way free through the crows, and led his people back north with the wolves howling at their heels. Only Gendel did not know the caves as Gorn had, and took a wrong turn.
She swept the torch back and forth, so the shadows jumped and moved.
Deeper he went, and deeper, and when he tried to turn back, the ways that seemed familiar ended in stone rather than sky. Soon his torches began to fail, one by one, till finally there was naught but dark. Gendel's folk were never seen again, but on a still night you can hear their children's children's children sobbing under the hills, still looking for a way back up. Listen. Do you hear them?
All Jon could hear was the falling water and the faint crackle of flames. This way under the wall was lost as well.
Some have searched for it. Them that go too deep find Gendel's children, and Gendel's children are always hungry.
Smiling, she set the torch carefully in the notch of rock, and came toward him.
"There's naught to eat in the dark but flesh,"
she whispered, biting at his neck. Jon nuzzled her hair and filled his nose with the smell of her.
"You sound like old Nan, telling Bran a monster story."
Ygritte punched his shoulder.
"An old woman, am I?"
"You're older than me."
"Aye, and wiser. You know nothing, Jon Snow."
She pushed away from him and shrugged out of her rabbit-skin vest.
"What are you doing?" "Showing you how old I am."
She unlaced her doeskin shirt, tossed it aside, pulled her 3 woolen undershirts up over her head all at once.
"I want you should see me."
"We shouldn't."
"We should."
Her breast bounced as she stood on one leg to pull one boot, then hopped onto the other foot to attend to the other. Her nipples were wide pink circles.
"You as well,"
Ygritte said, as she yanked down her sheepskin breeches.
"If you want to look, you have to show. You know nothing, Jon Snow."
"I know I want you," he heard himself say, all his vows and all his honor forgotten. She stood before him, naked as her name day, and he was as hard as the rock around them. He had been in her 50 times by now, but always beneath the furs and with others all around them.
He'd never seen how beautiful she was.
Her legs were skinny but well muscled, the hair at the juncture of her thighs a brighter red than that on her head.
"Does that make it even luckier?"
He pulled her close.
"I love the smell of you," he said. "I love your red hair. I love your mouth and the way you kiss me. I love your smile. I love your tits."
He kissed them, one and then the other.
"I love your skinny legs and what's between them."
He knelt to kiss her there, lightly on her mound at first, but Ygritte moved her legs apart a little, and he saw the pink inside, and kissed that as well, and tasted her. She gave a little gasp.
"If you love me all so much, why are you still dressed?" she whispered. "You know nothing, Jon Snow, Afterwards,
she was almost shy, or as shy as Ygritte ever got.
"That thing you did," she said when they lay together on their pile clothes, "with your mouth,"
she hesitated,
"is that what lords do to their ladies down in the south?"
"I don't think so. No one had ever told John just what lords did with their ladies. I only wanted to kiss you there, that's all. You seem to like it."
I liked it some. No one taught you such."
"There's been no one," he confessed. "Only you."
"A maid," she teased. "You were a maid."
He gave her closest nipple a playful pinch. "I was a man of the night's watch."
"Was?"
he heard himself say. What was he now? He did not want to look at that. "Were you a maid?" Ygritte pushed herself onto an elbow.
"I am 19, and a spear wife, and kissed by fire. How could I be maiden?"
"Who was he?"
"A boy at a feast, 5 years past. He'd come trading with his brothers, and he had hair like mine, kissed by fire, so I thought he would be lucky. But he was weak. When he came back to try and steal me, Longspear broke his arm and ran him off, and he never tried again, not once."
"It wasn't Longspear, then?" John was relieved. He liked Longspear, with his homely face and friendly ways. She punched him.
"That's vile. Would you bed your sister?"
"Longspear's not your brother."
"He's of my village. You know nothing, John Snow. A true man steals a woman from afar to strengthen the clan. Women who bed brothers or fathers or clan kin offend the gods and are cursed with weak and sickly children, even monsters."
"Craster weds his daughters," John pointed out. She punched him again.
"Craster's more your kind than ours. His father was a crow who stole a woman out of White Tree Village, but after he'd had her, he flew back to his wall. She went to Castle Black, once to show the crow his son, but the brothers blew their horns and run her off. Craster's blood is black, and he bears a heavy curse."
She ran her fingers lightly across his stomach.
"I feared you'd do the same once, fly back to the wall. You never knew what to do after you stole me."
John sat up. "Ygritte, I never stole you."
"Aye, you did. You jumped down the mountain and killed Orel, and afore I could get my axe, you had a knife at my throat. I thought you'd have me then, or kill me, or maybe both. But you never did. And when I told you the tale of Bale the Bard, and how he plucked the Rose of Winterfell, I thought you'd know to pluck me then for certain, but you didn't. You know nothing, Jon Snow."
She gave him a shy smile.
"You might be learning some, though."
The light was shifting all about her, John noticed suddenly. He looked around. "We'd best go up. The torch is almost done."
"Is the crow afraid of Gendel's children?" she said with a grin. "It's only a little way up, and I'm not done with you, Jon Snow."
She pushed him back down on the clothes and straddled him.
"Would you—"
she hesitated. "What?" he prompted, as the torch began to gutter.
"Do it again?"
Ygritte blurted.
"With your mouth? The Lord's kiss. And I could see if you liked it any."
By the time the torch burned out, Jon Snow no longer cared. His guilt came back afterwards, but weaker than before. If this is so wrong, he wondered, why did the guards make it feel so good? The grotto was pitch dark by the time they finished. The only light was the dim glow of the passage back up to the larger cavern, where a score of fires burned. They were soon fumbling and bumping into each other as they tried to dress in the dark. Ygritte stumbled into the pool and screeched at the cold of the water. When John laughed, she pulled him in too. They wrestled and splashed in the dark, and then she was in his arms again, and it turned out They were not finished after all.
"Jon Snow," she told him, when he'd spent his seed inside her, "don't move now, sweet. I like the feel of you in there. I do. Let's not go back to Styr and Jarl. Let's go down inside and join up with Gendel's children. I don't ever want to leave this cave, Jon Snow. Not ever."
Daenerys. "All?" The slave girl sounded weary.
"Your Grace, did this one's worthless ears mishear you?"
Cool green light filtered down through the diamond-shaped panes of coloured glass set in the sloping triangular walls, and a breeze was blowing gently through the terrace doors, carrying the scents of fruit and flowers from the garden beyond. "Your ears heard true," said Danny. "I want to buy them all. Tell the good masters, if you will." She had chosen a Carthian gown today. The deep violet silk brought out the purple of her eyes. The cut of it bared her left breast. While the good masters of Astapor conferred among themselves in low voices, Danny sipped tart persimmon wine from a tall silver flute. She could not quite make out all they were saying, but she could hear the greed. Each of the 8 brokers was attended by 2 or 3 body slaves, though one, Grasdan, the eldest, had 6. So as not to seem a beggar, Danny had brought her own attendants, Iri and Jiqui, in their sand-silk trousers and painted vests, Old Whitebeard and Mighty Belwas, her blood riders. Sir Jorah stood behind her, sweltering in his green surcoat with a black bear of Mormont embroidered upon it. The smell of his sweat was an earthy answer to the sweet perfumes that drenched the Astapori. "All," growled Krasny's Mon Nakhlos, who smelled of peaches today. The slave girl repeated the word in the common tongue of Westeros.
"Of thousands there are 8. Is this what she means by all? There are also 6 centuries, who shall be part of a 9,000 when complete. Would she have them too?"
"I would," said Danny when the question was put to her. "The 8,000s, the 6 centuries, and the ones still in training as well, the ones who have not earned the spikes." Krasny's turned back to his fellows. Once again they conferred amongst themselves. The translator had told Danny their names, but it was hard to keep them straight. 4 of the men seemed to be named Grasdan, presumably after Grasdan the Great, who had founded Old Gis in the dawn of days. They all looked alike, thick, fleshy men with amber skin, broad noses, dark eyes. Their wiry hair was black, or dark red, or a queer mixture of red and black that was peculiar to Giscari. All wrapped themselves in tokars, a garment permitted only to freeborn men of Astapor. It was the fringe of the tokar that proclaimed a man's status, Danny had been told by Captain Grolier. In this cool green room atop the pyramid, 2 of the slavers wore tokars fringed in silver, 5 had gold fringes, and 1, the oldest Grasdan, displayed a fringe of fat white pearls that clacked together softly when he shifted in his seat or moved an arm.
"We cannot sell half-trained boys,"
one of the silver-fringed Grasdans was saying to the others.
"We can, if our gold is good, eh?"
said a fatter man whose fringe was gold.
"They are not unsullied. They have not killed their sucklings. If they fail in the field, they will shame us, and even if we cut 5,000 war boys tomorrow, it would be 10 years before they are fit for sale. What would we tell the next buyer who comes seeking unsullied?"
"We will tell him that he must wait, eh?"
said the fat man.
"Gold in my purse is better than gold in my future."
Danny let them argue, sipping the tart persimmon wine and trying to keep her face blank and ignorant. "I will have them all, no matter the price," she told herself. The city had 100 slave traders, but the 8 before her were the greatest. When selling bed slaves, field hands, scribes, craftsmen, and tutors, these men were rivals. But their ancestors had allied one with the other for the purpose of making and selling the unsullied. Brick and blood built Astapor, and brick and blood her people. It was Krasny's who finally announced their decision.
Tell her that the 8,000 she shall have, if her gold proves sufficient, and the 6 centuries, if she wishes. Tell her to come back in a year, and we will sell her another 2,000.
In a year I shall be in Westeros, said Danny, when she heard the translation. My need is now. The Unsullied are well trained, but even so many will fall in battle. I shall need the boys as replacements to take up the swords they drop. She put her wine aside and leaned toward the slave girl. Tell the good masters that I will want even the little ones who still have their puppies. Tell them that I will pay as much for the boy they cut yesterday as for an Unsullied in a spiked helm. The girl told them. The answer was still no. Danny frowned in annoyance. Very well. Tell them I will pay double, so long as I get them all.
Double, eh?
The fat one in the gold fringe orb drooled.
This little whore is a fool, truly, said Krasny's Monaklos. Ask her for triple, I say. She is desperate enough to pay. Ask for 10 times the price of every slave, yes.
The tall Grasden, with a spiked beard, spoke in the common tongue, though not so well as the slave girl.
Your grace, he growled, Westeros is being wealthy, yes, but you are not being queen now. Perhaps will never being queen. Even Unsullied may be losing battles to savage steel knights of 7 kingdoms. I am reminding the good masters of Astapor are not selling flesh for promises. Are you having gold and trading goods sufficient to be paying for all these eunuchs you are wanting?
You know the answer to that better than I, good master, Danny replied. Your men have gone through my ships and tallied every bead of amber and jar of saffron. How much do I have?
Sufficient to be buying 1,000, the good master said with a contemptuous smile. Yet you are paying double, you are seeing. 5 centuries, then, is all you buy.
Your pretty crown might buy another century, said the fat one in Valyrian. Your crown of the 3 dragons.
Danny waited for his words to be translated. My crown is not for sale. When Viserys sold their mother's crown, the last joy had gone from him, leaving only rage. Nor will I enslave my people, nor sell their goods and horses. But my ships you can have. The great cog, Balerion, and the galleys, Vhagar and Meraxes. She had warned Grolio and the other captains it might come to this, though they had protested the necessity of it furiously. 3 good ships should be worth more than a few paltry eunuchs. The fat Grasden turned to the others. They conferred in low voices once again.
2,000,
the one with the spiked beard said when he turned back.
It is too much, but the good masters are being generous, and your need is being great.
2,000 would never serve for what she meant to do. I must have them all. Danny knew what she must do now, though the taste of it was so bitter that even the persimmon wine could not cleanse it from her mouth. She had considered long and hard, and found no other way. It is my only choice. Give me all, she said. And you may have a dragon. There was a sound of indrawn breath from Jikri beside her. Krasny smiled at his fellows.
Did I not tell you, eh? Anything she would give us.
Whitebeard stared in shocked disbelief. His hand trembled where it grasped the staff.
No. He went to one knee before her. Your grace, I beg you, win your throne with dragons, not slaves. You must not do this thing.
You must not presume to instruct me. Sir Jorah, remove Whitebeard from my presence. Mormont seized the old man roughly by an elbow, yanked him back to his feet, and marched him out onto the terrace. Tell the good masters I regret this interruption, said Danny to the slave girl. Tell them I await their answer. She knew the answer, though. She could see it in the glitter of their eyes and the smiles they tried so hard to hide. Astapor had 1,000s of eunuchs, and even more slave boys waiting to be cut. But there were only 3 living dragons in all the great wide world. And the Giscari lust for dragons. How could they not?
Five times had old Gis contended with Valeria when the world was young, and five times gone down to bleak defeat. For the freehold had dragons, and the empire had none.